Hello and welcome to today's Understanding Depression teleconference. All lines will be on listen only throughout today's presentation. There will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Today's conference call is being recorded. Should you object, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host, Catherine Fakin. You may begin.
On behalf of the National Kidney Foundation, welcome. My name is Kathy Pagan. I'm the NKF Transplant Programs Director and a social worker. We're so glad you have joined us today. Today's call will focus on the unique role that social workers can play in empowering transplant recipients to recognize symptoms of depression and seek treatment. So today we're going to talk about why transplant recipients may get depressed, what's out there to help, and why treatment is so important. With great pleasure, let me introduce Mary Beth Callahan, ACSW, LCSW, our keynote speaker. Mary Beth has spent over 20 years in nephrology social work and currently works at the Dallas Transplant Institute. She is responsible for psychosocial assessment and counseling of pre- and post-transplant patients, as well as living donors and families. In 2005, she participated in a telephone conference to educate transplant recipients and family members around the country about this same topic. She is on the editorial board of Dialysis and Transplantation and Family Focus and has published extensively in numerous professional nephrology journals. A former chair of CNSW, she co-developed CNSW's outcomes training program and serves on the medical review board of Network 14. I also want to thank Wyeth for their generous support of today's call. Well, we've got a lot to cover, so let's get started.
Thank you, Kathy. As many of us social workers know all too well, depression is extremely common in the United States. Depression also impacts the transplant recipients in our care, so for that reason, I'm happy to have the opportunity to talk about this today. First, I'll take a moment to say that I'm thankful to Wyeth for their funding for this program, and I do not have any financial interest in their company or products. Now about depression. In the next 45 minutes, we will cover symptoms, causes, treatment options, psychosocial and medical issues, and the role of medications. We chose to allow more participants today, which made it such that we could not do PowerPoint during the presentation today, but you will find a PowerPoint presentation in approximately 3 weeks on the National Kidney Foundation website. Responding to this call, and Kathy will tell you more about that later.
Sure will.
We will share with you later a case study about a heart recipient who has much to teach us about the human spirit and the ability of transplant recipients to overcome clinical depression. But first, let's start with the basics. Living with a new organ has daily challenges. Most of these challenges you know all too well. Adjusting to body image changes, negotiating hospital and insurance systems, budgeting, finances, employment, coping with the side effects of medications, and perhaps dashed expectations about what life would be like after transplant. Expectations may not be realized, and problems that one thought would end may remain. Recipients may begin to need help or still need help and have trouble accepting or asking for it. And all of this comes on top of the trials and tribulations that arise for everyone, transplant or not. It's normal to have challenges and anxiety. Anxiety and depression often go hand in hand. Transplant recipients and their families need to find a way to adapt to the changes that they will experience as a result of a change in chronic illness. And each recipient needs a solution that is right for them based on their individual needs and uniqueness. We are here today to learn about depression so we can help recipients recognize it and take advantage of treatment options. We have a lot of information that we hope will be useful for you. The National Kidney Foundation's goal is to make lives better. NKF is here to bring you the information and tools you need to engage your patients in understanding that depression is treatable. We're so happy to have each and every one of you here with us today. Depression is very common. Research shows that in any given year, almost 10% of the U.S. population is depressed. That's about 19 million adults with and without transplants. And for people with chronic illness, the incidence of depression is much higher. Some research suggests that up to 25% of people with illnesses become depressed at some point in their lives. Let's begin by reviewing 9 symptoms of depression. One of the classic symptoms is feeling depressed for most of the day, almost every day. A person may also feel like they don't enjoy things they once did, such as going to work or visiting friends. A person could gain weight or lose weight. Other symptoms include sleep problems, maybe sleeping too much or not sleeping enough, feeling restless, can also get very tired, like you have no energy, and having feelings of worthlessness and guilt are also common. A person may have trouble concentrating and thinking a lot about suicide. This is also a clear indication that a person could be depressed. So to sum up, 9 symptoms of depression are feeling depressed all day, not enjoying things you once did, weight changes, sleeping problems, feeling restless, fatigue, feeling worthless, lack of focus, and thinking about suicide. And any symptom has to last at least 2 weeks before most healthcare providers will diagnose depression. Technically, you need to have at least 5 of these 9 symptoms for at least 2 weeks before doctors will diagnose depression. This is so that people who have bad days here and there are not misdiagnosed. So, what are some of the causes of depression in transplant recipients? Environment and life events can cause someone's risk of depression to increase. Depression is much more common in people with physical illness than in others. One study showed that up to 1/3 of hospitalized people have mild to moderate symptoms of depression. And in transplant patients, it may be even higher for many reasons. Like I said earlier, depression is a physical condition. Some people are at a risk of developing depression when life becomes difficult, such as after divorce, job loss, deteriorating health, and, you guessed it, after a transplant. If a person was prone to depression before transplant, they're equally at risk afterwards, if not more so, because of the added stress from transplant. Plus, studies show that up to 1/4 of people who are depressed after a physical illness had depression before they became ill. The extraordinary experience of transplant can compound feelings of depression. People are often more likely to develop depression when life gets harder. But on top of that, there are some transplant medicines that can cause depression as a side effect. For instance, steroids such as prednisone, which many recipients take to avoid rejection of their new organ, can cause depression. Prednisone has a whole range of other side effects. Violent mood swings. Some people may get a feeling of euphoria with prednisone. Many people can't fall asleep. And a small number of people also have psychotic episodes from the drug. I sometimes have to remind my patients that having a transplant is a life-altering experience. The range of emotions they feel as a result of the procedure can definitely trigger depression in those who are susceptible to it. It can be incredibly difficult to accept that one of the organs we were born with no longer works. For many, organ failure can feel like a profound loss. Some people acknowledge the loss and grieve over it, which is totally understandable. Sometimes this grief can lead to depression. I've also come to understand that having a transplant creates another loss. By changing a life in an irreversible way, a recipient may grieve that he can no longer lead the same life as before. Much is the same, but now doctors and medications have to be relied upon to stay well. For many of us, that would be very hard to accept. It's important to stress during the pre-transplant phase that transplant is a treatment option, not a cure. This can make adapting to the complicated medical regimen post-transplant easier. Many transplant recipients are now free from dialysis. The dream of this freedom, for some, may have not been realistic. Being free from dialysis does not mean that life with a transplant will be easy. A new recipient may be surprised at some of the physical, financial, and social challenges that accompany a transplant that they did not have to deal with while on dialysis. For example, they are no longer eligible for many of the Medicare and insurance copay assistance programs that helped them financially when they were on dialysis. They are now also facing losing Medicare coverage after 36 months after transplant and the stress of planning for that change, particularly if they've been on dialysis for a long time. Dealing with chronic illness can intensify a person's dependence on family, friends, and social systems. A person can also feel sad that they have become dependent on their families. They may feel like illness disrupts their lives and may sense greater dependence emotionally and sometimes financially. For people who are used to being the sole providers for their family, that can be really tough. For people who have been on dialysis for a long time, expectations from others now that the transplant has come can seem overwhelming and create anxiety, which can lead to depression. Financially, many transplant recipients also worry about their futures and how to afford the medications they'll need for the rest of their lives. People with kidney transplants often worry about their health insurance, knowing that they will lose Medicare upon which they have become dependent. Transplant recipients may also worry about their future. This may be the first time they have faced a serious health risk, and that can be scary. With a transplant, a recipient may never be sure how long the organ will last. And then what? Very likely, if they were on dialysis, they had become used to seeing people with failed organs return. And when a person feels poorly physically, that makes all of this fear, frustration, and uncertainty even harder to bear. Plus, all of these feelings come on top of anything else the transplant recipient was dealing with at the time. Many people are on the transplant list for 5 or more years. It's difficult to live life waiting for that call to come that will change their life, then to suddenly have what you were waiting for all that time. Then what? Life can be hard even if you don't need a transplant. Family, career, finances, these make life challenging for everyone. So when you add it all together, you can see why depression becomes an issue for so many transplant recipients. Another thing I hear my transplant patients say a lot is that they feel pressure to be happy all the time after their transplant. There aren't enough donor organs to go around, and people say they feel they need to be grateful all the time for the kidneys or the organs they've received. When transplant recipients tell me they think they need to feel happy all of the time, I remind them that they are indeed blessed to receive a new organ, but that doesn't mean that they have no right to feel sad ever again or to get discouraged about the burden this new organ places on them. I've also found that it's hard for recipients to explain to people that having a transplant doesn't mean you're cured. That's something I hear all the time. In general, the average person does not understand what it's like to have a transplant. For that reason, the people around the transplant recipient may think that they are good as new and all health problems are solved. Expectations may be set accordingly. It will take time for them to understand there's a new set of challenges, that life will need to be lived on pause during those challenges. Some of my patients also tell me that they feel guilty for taking an organ from another person. If it's a kidney, maybe they got it from a loved one who gave such a wonderful gift. They can never thank their donors enough. Feelings are part of our being human. Some also say they feel sad that someone had to die to give them a new organ. They feel uncomfortable that they are benefiting from someone else's tragedy. When transplant recipients receive new diagnoses like hepatitis C or cancer or diabetes or others, it can also be a devastating blow. Finding out a kidney or organ is failing or that they are facing chronic rejection are often events that again can precipitate depression. All of these are very natural feelings after transplant, and unfortunately, they can all accumulate in depression. So, what should we do if we suspect a recipient is depressed? Why is it so important to deal with it? Well, there are a lot of misconceptions out there about depression, and one of the biggest ones is that it's possible to snap out of it, that a simple shift in attitude or circumstance will make depression go away. We know that that's simply not true. Like I said earlier, depression is a medical condition, like diabetes. You can't snap out of diabetes. It's the same with depression. You need professional help in the form of therapy or medication to treat depression. And without treatment, you may even get worse. The belief that depression is something you can snap out of is somewhat self-defeating because it implies that if you can't snap out of it, you're weak. It implies that if you were stronger, you wouldn't be depressed. And this is simply not true. You can't snap out of depression, but there are many things that social workers can do to help someone who is depressed. Treatment for depression can improve one's physical health as well. Research shows that people who are depressed are less likely to take their medications and less likely to stick with rehabilitation programs. Plus, they are more likely to develop additional illnesses, like heart problems. And for people with chronic illness, like transplant recipients, those who are depressed tend to fare worse over time. But when people who are diagnosed and treated for depression, they recover better from physical illness. It's important to let recipients know that depression can have devastating effects on family and loved ones. When a person is depressed, they may not be able to recognize that the whole family is probably suffering. If a family member comes in explaining that the recipient is depressed, you want to make sure this caregiver or partner is helped as well. Research also shows that if a patient is depressed, their spouse is more likely to become depressed also. Depression causes stress, which can raise levels of free radicals and fatty acids, the harmful molecules that can damage blood vessels. Stress can also cause changes that may alter the blood flow. So, there are a lot of reasons why it's important to help transplant recipients identify and manage depression. To summarize, these include managing depression reduces stress that can increase problems with blood pressure that can worsen problems with cardiovascular disease. Managing depression improves adherence to medical recommendations. Managing depression gives a new perspective on problems with family, friends, and coworkers. It improves coping with the side effects of medications. It enhances ways to talk to other people, thus increasing a person's support system. And it educates the patient about watching for early signs to manage depression in the future as well as at this time. When depression is identified, we of course need to assess the need for hospitalization. If there is not a present need for hospitalization due to suicidal ideation or thoughts and plans, we can talk with the patients to assess the duration and the intensity of the depressive episode. It's important to rule out other causes of depression, such as medication interactions. Again, it is important to engage the family whenever possible. When assessing for depression, it's ideal to use a screener such as the PHQ-2 or 9 or the Beck Fast Screen for Medical Patients to get a baseline and to measure the effectiveness of the ensuing interventions. Many of the instruments will be listed on the website in approximately 3 weeks for you to be able to review. Engaging the patient into treatment involves sharing the screening results, reducing the stigma of depression, discussing the risks of not treating the depression, in discussing treatment options, and exploring the patient's concerns. Now we will talk about treatment options and how to move patients toward treatment. The two principal types of treatment for depression are therapy and medication. They can work in combination or separately. The most common type of therapy is called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. As part of the cognitive portion of the treatment, the social worker helps the patient correct any negative thought patterns that may be causing depression. For instance, if a recipient is constantly feeling hopeless or that there's no point in living, the social worker helps the patient think through this and change the thinking, breaking down the problem he perceives into smaller, more manageable parts. The other part of cognitive behavioral therapy is the behavioral part. This focuses on how a person behaves in certain situations. If those behaviors aggravate their depression, a social worker may help a patient avoid behaviors that are really self-defeating, such as sleeping all day or avoiding the things the patient used to enjoy. There are also other types of therapy. A combination of types of treatment may be used depending on which is best suited to the patient's needs. Sometimes cognitive behavioral classes or group therapy may be a good option. I generally tell patients that one-on-one sessions last about 45 or 50 minutes, during which you can talk about your feelings, whatever is on your mind. And the social worker or the psychologist can help you with problem solving, identifying feelings, or any number of things to make sure that you are talking about what is helpful for your depression. If you're in a group or a class session, you share your experience with others and listen to them talk about themselves. Sometimes hearing other people's stories helps us feel less alone and we can learn from their experience. In the information that will be on the website, there will be examples of classes that you might want to consider beginning for transplant recipients. I always remind transplant recipients that depression and anxiety are very common and to let someone know how they are feeling. Our assessment that a recipient is depressed may come as a surprise to doctors. Many recipients want to impress their doctors and don't want to complain or seem ungrateful. Collaboration is very important in bringing about the best outcome. There will be times when we assess someone as depressed and needing longer-term intervention. It is helpful to have community resources available if you do not feel comfortable treating the diagnosis. Often, I may see a patient 3 or 4 times, and if longer intervention is necessary, I will refer out so that they can have as many sessions as needed. Often we'll continue to see each other and work on other needs along with short-term counseling. Medications are something I know a lot of transplant recipients are concerned about. The last thing many transplant recipients want to do is to take another pill. But I've seen so many recipients benefit from antidepressants. And a lot of research shows that they can help people with illness without side effects. We encourage transplant recipients to consider them if depression is a problem. Sometimes people seeking a transplant are concerned that if they are taking an antidepressant, it will keep them from being a transplant candidate. I try to calm that fear. In fact, whenever I meet a transplant candidate who has signs of depression and perhaps a family history, but has been holding off taking an antidepressant because of concerns about being accepted for a transplant, I explain the benefits of starting an antidepressant before their operation to help them through a period of increased stress and side effects from transplant medications. I suggest reassessing their need for antidepressants about 3 months after transplant, when life, hopefully, returns to some degree of normalcy. The main types of antidepressants are tricyclic antidepressants, or TCAs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, and serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, or SNRIs. These medicines work by correcting the chemical imbalance in the brain that causes depression. Most often, doctors will start people on an SSRI. Each drug works a little differently in different people. Sometimes there are also side effects in the first few days of taking some of these medicines, and these side effects, such as nausea, subside later. It's important to educate the patient about these temporary side effects and that they won't see results right away, but maybe after 3 or 4 weeks. During this time, we as social workers will be checking with them to see if the medication needs to be adjusted or changed. Many times I find that when the prescribing physician is focused on another medical issue like transplant, measuring the effectiveness of the antidepressant gets lost. We, as social workers, are in the best position to measure the patient's depression at baseline, 2 weeks later, and then at 6 weeks and 3 months. This may not be the schedule that you use, but measuring at baseline and measuring at follow-up are important. Only 30% of people with depression go into full remission after taking their first course of antidepressants, according to a 2006 study funded by the National Institutes of Health. Those who got better were more likely to be taking slightly higher doses for longer periods than other people. Remember, it's important to treat to remission, not to response, and to reinforce education to the patient about the need to continue with treatment until remission. Education about this can be 30 seconds to 1 minute, but to try and help them remember the whole picture. Some antidepressants work better for certain individuals than others. It's not uncommon to try a few different depression medications during treatment, and some people need more than one depression medication at a time. If the dose of medication is not at the best level, or perhaps it's not the best medication to treat the patient's depression, the patient may feel more discouraged and will not want to try another antidepressant in the future. I'm sure we've all had patients who come to us with this story. As mentioned earlier, there are several low-cost, quick measures for depression, and a list of these will be on the NKF website for your review. I encourage us all to remember to measure, to work with our team, as they look at providing antidepressant medication to our patients. Some people fear that antidepressants are addictive or will get them high. These treatments simply correct the chemical imbalance that is causing depression. It's important to help the patient and their family understand this. Most antidepressants are believed to work by slowing the removal of certain chemicals from the brain. These chemicals are called neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters are needed for normal brain function. Antidepressants help people with depression by making these natural chemicals more available to the brain. Depression is a very treatable illness, and no one should suffer with depression. Older adults tend to react differently to antidepressants than younger adults. Children and teens may react differently than adults. For this reason, if you were treating an elderly person, the treatment may be very different than it would be with a younger person. The geriatric depression scale can be used in measuring baseline and follow-up for elderly patients with depression. This can be accessed for free on the Internet. At our center, we are careful to alert recipients to the danger of using St. John's wort and transplant medications. This is very important. A lot of people use herbal supplements or medicines to treat a variety of conditions. One of the very popular herbal medicines is St. John's wort, which is used to treat depression. I've heard interesting things about St. John's wort, and one reason for its appeal is that you can buy it at a health food store without a prescription. However, a crucial thing to remember about St. John's wort is that it may interfere with other drugs transplant recipients are taking. One of the drugs it may interfere with is cyclosporine, which people take to prevent transplant rejection. I've heard that transplant recipients have lost their organs after taking St. John's wort. Other herbal supplements may boost the immune system, which can be detrimental to someone who is immunosuppressed to maintain a transplant. There are potential side effects that can come from antidepressants, even non-herbal ones, but they can be managed, and a fear of side effects should not be a reason for a recipient to avoid treatment. As social workers, we need to let the patient know that we will walk this walk with them. Many private insurance plans provide drug coverage and pay for at least some counseling. I encourage recipients to contact their insurance provider to find out providers in their area if they wish to have long-term therapy, and to let me know if there's a problem for payment of an antidepressant that has been prescribed for them. Often our billing and accounts departments can find this information for them as long as their current insurance information is on file. People on Medicare are covered for a lifetime maximum of 190 days at an inpatient mental health facility. And for outpatient care, Medicare pays 50% of the Medicare allowed amount of a certain number of sessions. Medicare Part D, the prescription drug plan, plans differ in what antidepressants are covered. Medicaid, the government program that helps those with low income, will pay for a limited amount of inpatient and outpatient care. The program will also only pay for Medicaid-approved drugs. Some recipients may also qualify for assistance from pharmaceutical assistance companies that manufacture antidepressants. There are many ways that we can help the patient to manage depression. Some reports, although not all, have found that combining depression medicine with therapy can be particularly effective. A 2004 review published in the Archives of General Psychiatry concluded that therapy combined with antidepressants worked better than depression medication alone. Therapy and antidepressants are certainly the gold standard for depression, but it's important to begin by communicating. I encourage patients to talk about their feelings. That's why therapy is so successful. One social work colleague tells them, if you can mention it, you can manage it. For some recipients, a transplant education class or support group provides the emotional support that they need. Sharing with fellow recipients who can identify with the same experiences can be a great source of comfort. Some groups are run by social workers and some are run by peers. Some are jointly run. Both allow recipients to help each other and get help from the community. Topics that may be relevant for classes include managing changes post-transplant, realistic expectations post-transplant, the Council of Nephrology Social Workers Outcome Training Program gives an example of a depression management class in the module on interventions that identify and reduce depression. Some of the topics include understanding depression and how to feel better again, cognitive behavioral training and how it works, balancing your thinking, practicing new skills, preparing for success, maintaining and moving forward. Examples of what might be included in these classes will be able to be found on the NKF website, referring to today's discussion. Stepping back into life and feeling better again are two programs that an outline will be available for. Close friendships and support networks can be developed through these classes that can really help during tough times. Recipients ask me, why is talking about my feelings important? And some are very skeptical. I explain to them that many feelings that can cause depression, such as feeling alone or scared about the future, can be alleviated by talking to others. It makes sense that keeping things bottled up inside can make you feel a lot worse. A metaphor I like to use is that I think of life's trials and tribulations like a shaken soda bottle with a loose top. Transplant is worth at least 10 shakes. Then add more shakes to represent whatever other challenges you're facing. If you don't let out that accumulated air slowly through talking about your feelings with others, that bottle's going to explode. I explained that even without therapy, I imagine it would help to speak to someone when you're feeling sad. This can be a family member, a friend, a health professional, or someone at your place of worship. I recommend someone who will be sympathetic and just listen and not judge you. I also invite transplant recipients to participate in support groups and advocacy activities. I also recommend that we all consider some creative ways to express ourselves. These can be very private, so they work for people who don't feel comfortable talking to others. Writing about feelings can help. This includes any kind of writing, journal, poetry, even fiction. Playing music, pottery, or painting helps some people. I think each of these art forms helps by allowing us to express our feelings. By doing this, a person writes out what's inside of them, and that keeps it from bottling up. Art and creative activities allow us to express ourselves without considering what other people will think. If we write for ourselves, we don't think about what other people will react if they read it. People don't have to worry about seeming ungrateful for their transplant or complaining too much or thinking negative thoughts. No one can judge us, which is very freeing. Sometimes when a transplant recipient writes to the donor's family about transplant, it allows them to come to terms with the feelings they are having about receiving an organ from a deceased donor. People who try to write or paint or create something without thinking about it sometimes can truly relax, even if just for a little while. I think it's best to just let it flow without second thoughts. One way to do this is, of course, to write without using punctuation or to paint without lifting the brush off the page. This helps people really get into the flow and let things out that are maybe hiding deep. A few minutes per day or an hour or two per week may help a recipient express their feelings, and that will help them deal with depression. Another idea that may decrease depression is an increase in physical activity, even though the person may not feel like it. Increasing physical activity should always be checked out with a physician, but this can be an important step on the road to rehabilitation and improved mental status. A depressed person often must fight against having bad feelings every day and not feeling energy to do anything. However, it may not be too much to ask to use a few minutes per week if it means we will have lots of extra minutes of feeling less depressed. Looking at the complete person and including family to support and feel supported themselves may assist the recipient in their recovery. Meeting with the family and the doctor or the psychiatrist can let the recipient see that their emotions and depression are being taken seriously and that the medical team believes that they are worth discussing and treating. Now, even though art and communicating with others can help depression, I remind recipients that depression is a physical condition. These techniques simply help a person deal well with the condition that causes depression. Certain recipients, due to their life cycle positions, are at an increased risk for depression. In addition, many of our women recipients who are so excited about becoming pregnant may be unaware or unable to recognize the symptoms of postpartum depression after pregnancy. We need to be aware of this and educate new mothers in pregnant women that if they are pregnant or recently were and feeling depressed, it may be postpartum depression. There are many factors in pregnancy that could increase the risk of depression. On top of dealing with the transplant, you have intense changes in hormones and weight and stress from suddenly being totally responsible for another human being. New babies also need constant feeding, which disrupts sleep. With all of this going on, it's not surprising that new moms are particularly at risk of depression. Menopause is also a time when we may be more vulnerable to depression for similar reasons. Hormones are changing, bodies are changing radically, and all of this, compounded with a transplant, can make a person vulnerable to depression. Studies show that teenagers are very much more at risk of depression, perhaps because, like in pregnancy and menopause, their bodies are undergoing intense hormonal shifts. The teenage years are also a time of intense life changes as we transition from children to adults. People start to look at them differently, they have more responsibilities, and they need to start making important decisions about school and our careers. Teenagers may also be facing changing from pediatric to adult transplant programs, beginning new schools and other life changes that can set off panic. Dealing with depression in teenagers in transplant would be another full topic. Well, we have spent a lot of time talking about what depression is from a clinical perspective. I think it's also important to demonstrate what depression really feels like. We have a story to share. Kathy will tell you about a young woman, a transaction member, who generously shared her experiences with us with the goal of helping others.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Had actually participated on a conference call with Mary Beth and some other panelists 2 years ago, directly to recipients, telling her story about depression. And when we told her we were doing another program for social workers, she gave us an update on how she was doing the last 2 years and again told us any way she can help others, she was happy to share her story. She received a new heart in October 1995 under unique circumstances. She went into a hospital planning on getting open heart surgery, but it didn't go well, and she was given 2 weeks to live. She received a transplant within days. For the last time she was conscious, she went into open heart surgery, expecting to keep her heart, and when she came to, she had a new heart. During the day's waiting, she reported horrible hallucinations. She thought she had run over 2 children with her car and that her cousin was dead. She'd started seeing a psychologist before her open-heart surgery just to prepare for the surgery and then continued to see this psychologist after the transplant. She was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, resulting from the transplant operation experience. M says, and I quote, "I think the PTSD came from the trauma of suddenly having a transplant and all the emergency circumstances. I became overwhelmed by the hugeness of it all, and I also felt very claustrophobic. My life would no longer be the way it was before because of all the changes coming after the transplant. This made everything very final. My heart was gone. There was no going back. All of a sudden, my future was uncertain. I was worried about rejection, infections, how long my heart would last. It was terrifying." End of quote. Changes are the anti-rejection medications might have also influenced her feelings and maybe her hallucinations. She is certain that prednisone affected her moods. Em explained to me that she felt anxious knowing that she was carrying someone else's organ inside of her. As much as we strive for confidentiality, and it's not always a reality, she knew the circumstances of her donor, who was a 15-year-old boy, and found out her mother's cousin worked for the father. And she explained to me, and I quote again, quote, "When I received his heart, I felt pressure to try to live this boy's life for him. I wanted to do something really meaningful and impressive, to make something great come out of his death and have it be worthwhile. That first year after my transplant, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how I could win a Nobel Peace Prize. I also developed some classic signs of depression. I was oversleeping. I no longer felt like being social, which was very unlike me. I also felt really hopeless." End of quote. Em kept seeing her psychologist, and she explained that the psychologist really helped. The psychologist specialized in working with people with chronic illnesses and made her realize she was having a totally normal reaction to a situation, and that gave her relief. Soon after her transplant, she started taking antidepressants, and she continues to take them. Em, as the transplant team recommended, decided to treat her mental health like it was her physical health. Her antidepressants became just as important as her anti-rejection medications, and she takes them every day. But she admits it's hard, and it was very hard to start. Like other transplant recipients, she felt like she should be happy all the time since she was lucky to receive a transplant. She actually stopped taking her antidepressants once, but felt so sad and helpless afterwards she had to start again. This is to her credit that she was knowledgeable enough about depression that she recognized her symptoms and pursued treatment again. adding to the risk of depression was her place in her life cycle. She was in her 20s when she had her transplant and found it hard to find a community of peers that really understood where she's coming from. Young people under 30 who've had transplants are just a teeny, teeny percentage of transplant patients, and often the transplant experience affects their formative years. She had friends her age, but they were buying houses, getting married, having kids. And having a transplant affected how she approached and thought about these life choices. She worried that she may not be well enough for this type of responsibility. She wanted to get married and have children, but wonders, what if she would die early? What would happen to her family? Creative arts did help M. She took a writing course called Healing Through Writing at an independent writing center, and many other students were young, and she developed friendships there. One even had a lung transplant, and another had Crohn's disease. She explained the class was wonderful, and writing about her feelings was really cathartic, and hearing other women share similar feelings and worries made her feel understood and validated. Once the class was over, she remained friends with former classmates, and they still get together. And I want to quote M again. Quote, "And don't get me wrong, I've gotten a lot of help from my friends in the transplant community. I attended a transplant recipient support group for 2 years after my operation, and that was great. I also have a great sense of adventure. When I turned 30, two of my friends and I went to South Africa. They understood that I wanted to live my life to its fullest and not wait till I retire. I would like to give the following advice to fellow recipients. One thing I learned is that you may have to fight for your own mental health. Right after my transplant, my doctor couldn't handle it if I cried. All I needed were some words of encouragement, someone who said they understood my grief and my uncertainty about the future. He once joked that I should go shoot myself. So I switched programs, and now I go to a different hospital with a different doctor who is much more respectful. I think we all need to advocate for our own health, mental health, physical health, and our rights as transplant recipients. Last, for me, it was vital to give myself permission to live my life differently than my peers. And second, to give myself permission to grieve the losses that come with transplantation. For the next year and a half, Em continued to work on building a fulfilling life. The last year has been good, she says. When I told her about this telephone conference for social workers, she said that she would like to explain that she worked very hard to overcome depression and has found a feeling of connectedness with others. She explains, "I met someone right after I decided I would be single for the rest of my life. I had just purchased a loft in an old historic building so that I wouldn't have to shovel snow or call my dad to repair things, and then I met a really great, physically active and fun guy. We celebrated our first year anniversary. We laugh a lot. It's been an adjustment trying to explain what my health issues mean, especially since I cannot keep up with my peers, and it's not because I'm unmotivated or lazy. But he understands. He's been with me to one trip to the emergency room, and that has been very helpful to me. It's been scary, but having a partner that is not scared off by it helps. I miss occasionally checking in with my psychologist. I would advise social workers to make patients with chronic illness aware of any free or lower cost resources for mental health treatment that they can. Thank you for your continued interest and support, and please let me know if there's anything else I can do."
Thank you, Kathy, for telling that story. This is the story of a depressed recipient who became empowered enough to stand up to her healthcare team and make changes that she needed to make. We in the field know how hard that is to do. We need to listen to her story to remember that it is possible to help move a patient from depressed to empowered, and that we have to be ready to respond to patients when they are ready to change. It is helpful to have classes available that you can direct patients to for psychoeducation and peer support. In conclusion, I would like to say that we can drive home some important messages to the recipients we see. First, depression is not just in your head. It is a medical illness like diabetes or hypertension. And like other illnesses, you can't just snap out of it. If it's not treated, depression can have serious consequences. If you don't deal with your depression, it could affect your future and the health of your transplant. Thirdly, being diagnosed with depression doesn't mean you're crazy, not at all. It means you have a physical condition which makes you vulnerable to depression. This condition can be corrected through refocusing your thoughts with therapy and or with medicine. There are a lot of options, and it may take time to find the one that's right for you, but it's out there, so be patient. Being depressed is certainly not a sign of weakness, but admitting you have a problem and taking action to help yourself is certainly a sign of strength. In the treatment of depression, it is very important to treat to remission, not just response to the medication. Research shows that patients with depression should have at least 3 follow-up visits during the first 12 weeks of treatment. The longer patients stay on medication, the more likely they are to get to remission. An additional summary point is that during and following a transplant rejection, patients find themselves facing challenges for which they may not be well prepared. Common emotional reactions to kidney transplant rejection include disbelief, anger, sadness, irritability, fear, and depression, which may include questioning about what's going on. As social workers, we need to acknowledge the need for grieving, living life on pause, and identifying a readjustment plan.
Thank you so much, Mary Beth. I want to encourage all of you to take advantage of the information that will be posted on the website that Mary Beth has prepared. And in addition, this session will be podcast for your listening pleasure, along with the questions that we're now ready to take from you. We'll open up for questions now.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone keypad. Once again, that is star 1 to ask a question. Will be prompted to record your name for pronunciation purposes only. Once again, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question at this time. Our first question is from Miriam Zuckerman. You may begin.
I have any questions.
I'm sorry, ma'am?
I don't have any questions.
I'm sorry, you were in the queue. My apologies. Once again, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question at this time. Please stand by while any questions do register. I am showing no questions at this time.
Yes. Kathy, might I just add something for people to look at?
Sure.
A recent study that I looked at while preparing for this presentation is called the STAR-D study, and that acronym stands for Sequenced Treatment Alternatives to Relieve Depression. And it was funded by the National Institutes of Health. And one of the things that came home very strongly from that study was working with patients to total remission. And what a problem that was when they looked at over 4,000 patients that we often don't treat to remission, which leads to further depressive episodes and really discouragement for the patient. So I would just encourage you to perhaps look at that study. And we'll have the site for that on the website also.
Excellent.
This is the operator. We do have a question from Barbie Dickerson. You may begin.
Hi. Many of my patients won't take any antidepressant medications or go to counseling. You mentioned some alternatives like exercise and journaling and things like that, but are there any other alternatives that might help?
What do you think their resistance is to a medication?
Well, a lot of my patients tell me that they're already on many, many medications and they just won't add another one.
We hear that often also. Sometimes when we talk to them about the specifics of whether they're having any trouble sleeping, what is their appetite like, when we kind of break down how depression might be impacting their life, are they staying in bed, are they not talking with their friends anymore, we might be able to talk about a trial period for an antidepressant. Also, if they're totally opposed to the antidepressant, which some people are the classes which allow them to interact with people who are experiencing very similar feelings can be helpful. And when we talk about classes, we are not talking about 30 minutes of didactic teaching. We're talking about 10 minutes of prepared discussion, which you'll find on the website, and then allowing the people in the class to talk with each other. And as social workers, we're very able to facilitate that kind of discussion. But I would encourage someone in that situation to begin looking at some activity or what might be good for them.
One of these programs, Stepping Back into Life, which we hope NCAS will be able to make available widely soon in the future, is being pilot tested in Louisiana with Katrina, Rita survivors, and is really a wonderful program that gives some insight and some education for people that are coping with depression.
That's right, Kathy. Just to kind of give you an idea of what Stepping Back into Life offers, it's a three-part program that can be either chair-side or self-directed audio by the patient themselves. But the class topics are, number one, prevention, scheduling enjoyable activities. Number two, communication and problem-solving skills. And number three, prevention, and it talks about schema, how the person sees themselves. And it's not a complicated package at all, but we do hope it's widely available for social workers very soon. It will make it easier to offer these services.
And this was a program developed by social workers.
Thank you. Our next question is from Andrea Verdreen. You may begin.
Hi, I really enjoyed this teleconference. I also participated in the one about cancer risk after transplantation and was able to speak with the people on our active list here. I'm working in dialysis right now, and they found the information I gave them from that very helpful. So I know now that I can go back to these 16 people that we have and make them aware of what the signs and symptoms are of depression so that they can look for these after transplantation. My question is, do you have any other recommendations that I should do with them now?
Well, and I'm sorry that you have to wait for this. Again, we opted to allow more people to participate in today's conference than having the PowerPoint immediately available. But in 3 weeks, there will be, in addition to Stepping Back into Life, Feeling Better Again, which is another depression management class for people with chronic kidney disease, will be, the outline will be on the website. And it gives people an understanding about depression and how to feel better again. Talks a little bit about cognitive behavioral training, and each of these would be bite-sized pieces. The other thing that I might say to you, since you have an interest in this area, is to consider doing measurements with some of the people, just to, if you haven't already done it, to see if indeed, if they took a, you know, 9-question inventory, what would that look like? Would they be experiencing mild depression, moderate depression, no depression? And maybe think about what to do to go from there. And also, the patients in your population, Andrea, can explore some of the websites on transplant, which might help them to be better prepared in terms of knowing all the emotional experiences that might be coming forth after the transplant.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Elizabeth Purnell's line. Thank you. You may begin. Ms. Purnell, is your phone on mute? I'm sorry, we're unable to hear anything on that line. Our next question is from Deborah Winston. You may begin.
Yes. I'm Deborah Winston from UT Hospital. And I often work with pediatric patients, both dialysis and transplant patients. But what I'm finding is a lot of their parents are suffering from depression, which spills over into the kids. What can I do to better assess the parents' depressive symptoms in order to help them cope with their children's illness?
And, you know, I must admit straight away that that is not my area of expertise, but we will have some tools on the website for assessment. I think in that situation it might be helpful to have small groups of parents, two or three, be able to talk with each other to gain support. If you feel like they are depressed, I think that you could use the same measurement to assess that. And you, I don't know if your situation allows you to do counseling or not, or if that would require referral to someone else. But in their adaptation as a family to chronic illness, that might be helpful.
Mm. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
Our
you.
Next question is from Jim Hafner. You may begin.
Hi, can you all hear me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for this presentation, Mary Beth. I appreciate it. The question I have is in relation to kind of a locus of control when someone was mentioning we can't get patients to take medications. I'm wondering how much time, how many times people feel that they're afraid to let go. If they do acknowledge that they're depressed, that then that's going to create more of an emotional overflow or a loss of control in their lives. The other part of this is in relation to, in a structured setting like the clinics, we're encouraging a sense of independence and self-reliance, trying to help people regain their sense of control in their life again. But at the same time, the underlines of within the clinics is to direct and dictate what is best for the person. And I think maybe there's some incongruence with that. If you could comment about that, I would appreciate it.
Well, Jim, thank you for that difficult question.
My ethical dilemmas all the time.
I know. We all do, don't we? I'm not sure that I can recall all of it, but let me just start out with the idea that, again, if we see people who are depressed and we kind of follow this line of thinking that we've talked about today, we would anticipate that there's a chemical imbalance and that something might need to be done to change that, whether that's medication or exercise or whatever. I do think that you're right that the dialysis setting for patients makes it such a situation that they do have to give over a lot of control. And I'm happy personally that self-care dialysis is really making a big comeback. And I know in the early days we did self-care not only at home but also more self-care in the dialysis facilities. I think education, continuing to remind the patients and to provide education in ways that they can understand, will help them to become empowered also. I know that most of you are aware of the Life Options Rehabilitation Advisory Council website, Life Options, which has many tools to provide education. Also, you might look at a time life management tool for the patients, which we can put on the website. This allows them to list things in their life that fill their time as essential and not flexible, enjoy it, don't enjoy it, and how they may want to reorganize, and give them a couple of calendar sheets to look at to see what they're going to plan for the next week or something like that, just to put them in more control and to let them visualize that they're in more control. I think it helps me, whether I'm dieting or whatever is going on, to have a visual related to what I'm trying to motivate myself to do.
That's a good point. Thank you. Just another quick feedback comment, too. I think as far as empowering, I think you've mentioned in one of your listserv comments, I think there's a strong role that we need to keep advocating for the type of environment within which patients come to us and to make sure that they are given the sense of esteem or at least provided an opportunity, an avenue, to begin to work through these issues that they have to in regaining the sense of power and control and boosting their self-esteem, not again trying to control them, which I think is kind of an ongoing concern. But thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Jim. So really setting the stage from the very beginning that we want to encourage their involvement in their care.
Right.
That is the tone of our relationship with them as a team.
I think when you ask what's important for them, you're getting to know them as a person, you're getting to know them, what's going to motivate them, and hopefully that in and of itself will help stimulate them to, well, I'm tired of feeling this way, I really want to be able to interact more with my children, be able to return back to work, or whatever the motivation or level of that might be. That's what we need to tie into in order to stimulate them to kind of do what's best for them.
Thank you, Jim. Really good comments. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And I want to thank everyone who joined us. It's probably time for us to stop now. If there are additional questions and you would want to email me your comments or questions, I can certainly talk to Mary Beth and see what we can do to get back to you. My name, again, is Kathy Pagan, and on behalf of the People Like Us Division of the National Kidney Foundation, I thank you so much for joining us today, and we thank Wyeth for their support, and my email is CHYP@kidney.org, phone number 800-622-9010, extension 144, and I can correspond with Mary Beth. I know many of you that want the CEUs will be sending in the evaluations, and you can certainly also put your comments on the evaluation forms for us. And if you enjoyed this program, stay tuned, because on March 8th, we're going to have a call about empowering and advocating and transplant recipients, as our last question asker had brought up as an important topic, and that'll be on March 8th, World Kidney Day, at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you so much. Let me wish you happiness and health on behalf of the National Kidney Foundation, and let me thank our keynote speaker, Mary Beth.
And thank you to all of you who stayed with us today.